So we'll bring the committee to order, and we're meeting today to talk about, I think, a very important issue, and it's just really to kind of set the stage and do some learning for our committee so that as we move into the session and into the future, we have a better understanding of issues around chemical dependency and addiction and what the state's role is and what we can do better and what's working well. And part of it is driven by what we've been seeing in the news stories lately, which have kind of been filled with a number of individual stories of really tragic events. And, you know, I think we in Minnesota have a sense on issues around chemical dependency that we do a pretty good job at it. And historically we have, but I just looking at the issue, I think we do have some challenges we need to get our arms around. And so this is just the first this is a first step in that direction, and so I hope everybody kind of approaches that spirit, asks all the questions you need to ask, and we'll start with Dr. Bart. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Okay, my name is Dr. Gavin Bart. I am an internist and addiction specialist at Hennepin County Medical Center and University of Minnesota, and thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, for inviting me here. Would it be a problem if I stood up? Or is it easier to sit down?
We need to record it, so okay. It's probably easier to... Yeah.
Sometimes I get passionate about this, and it's hard to contain myself. Standing up is easier. I will sit. I really do want to thank you for inviting me to this presentation to talk about what is the number one preventable cause of death in the world, the addictive diseases. But first of all, if we're going to identify this disease, we need to figure out who's at risk. And throughout the world, we have an incredible number of people at risk for development of addiction, with over 1.3 billion smokers, 2 billion alcohol drinkers, and 185 million illicit drug users. So the World Health Organization has identified something that's known as the disability-adjusted life year, which is the number of life years lost due to premature death or disability. And if we look throughout the world at the top 10 causes of premature disability or death, three of the top 10 causes in the developed world are due to substances of misuse. Tobacco is number one, alcohol is number three, and illicit drugs number eight. The same pretty much holds true for the developing world, with alcohol and tobacco as three and one, respectively. So the World Health Organization estimates that 12.4% of all deaths in the world are attributed to substance use. And in fact, these deaths are occurring very early in life, with over half of all deaths related to illicit drugs occurring in the young, and two-thirds of deaths related to alcohol occurring in people younger than the age of 60. If we look within the United States, this is data on past year use. So in white is number of Americans who've used the substance, and in blue are the number who have developed dependence within the last year. So, for example, there are 162 million alcohol users within the last year, and one out of 20 of those alcohol users were alcoholics. And you can go down the list here to see one out of five cocaine users were addicted, one out of two heroin users were addicted, and quite worrisome is the number of people who are illicitly using prescription opiates, with an estimated 12 million Americans misusing them in the last year, and one out of 12 of them addicted to them. Within Minnesota, if we estimate the number of Minnesotans who need treatment for a substance use disorder but aren't receiving it, we find that there are 104,000 Minnesotans who need treatment for illicit drug use but aren't receiving it, and over 350,000 Minnesotans who need treatment for alcohol dependence and aren't for alcohol disorders and aren't receiving it. And with the number of committee members here, it's about 10. Oh, a reminder, about 36,000 members in each of your districts. So think of every man, woman, and child in your district. For every committee member here, that's about roughly the number of Minnesotans who need but aren't receiving treatment for a drug or alcohol use disorder. So what leads to addiction? Certainly you must be exposed to the drug, but it's also a complex interaction between genetics, between environment, and the pharmacological action of the drugs themselves. And I want to talk a little bit about this, especially because I get a lot of people asking me, well, is it nature, is it nurture? And I want to tell you it's both. These combine, and I'm going to talk about this for the next few slides. We know addictions run in families. The children of alcoholics have a fourfold increased risk of developing alcohol dependence themselves. And it's not just the environment, because we know from adoption studies, if a child of alcoholics is adopted to a teetotaling family at birth, they still have a fourfold increased risk of developing alcohol dependence. The power of genetics is quite strong. We also know that genetics mediates the effects of drugs. So, for example, children of alcoholics who are not alcoholic themselves respond differently to alcohol, subjectively and objectively, than the children of non-alcoholics. And that difference in response can actually be followed and correlated through time and relates to the future risk of developing alcohol dependence. Genes play a very strong role, but so does environment. We know that the family setting, we know the peer group also influences what we're exposed to, what is seen as acceptable behavior, and how we cope with the world around us. These interact together, and I want to show this interaction using an actual animal study rather than a human study. Dopamine receptors are the main receptors in the brain that mediate reward and learning. And these are PET images where the bright color is the density of dopamine receptors in the brain. These are two different monkeys. Monkeys are social creatures, much like human beings are. And when housed individually, there is no discernible difference between dopamine receptors in these two monkeys. But then, when put in a social setting of the group, they become social animals, and one becomes more dominant than the other, and one is subordinate. I am sorry, we missed the slide. I need to go backwards. Well, I will just make you have the slides, so I will tell you what they say, because it's not showing up here. When put into a social setting, the dominant monkey ends up having more dopamine receptors than the subordinate monkey. Then, next, when exposed to cocaine, each is allowed to use cocaine, but which one develops cocaine use more readily? It's the subordinate monkey with fewer dopamine receptors. They took to cocaine more easily than did the monkey who had more dopamine receptors. Well, this holds true in what we know from humans, where humans have, with addictions, have fewer dopamine receptors in the brain than those without. You can see on this slide, all of the panels on the right are addicts, and all of the panels on the left are normal volunteers. Fewer dopamine receptors on the right than on the left. But what is on the slide prior to this that I couldn't go to is that given enough exposure to cocaine, both monkeys ultimately ended up having the same dopamine receptors. The pharmacological action of the drug itself alters the brain, and so while social subordination and social dominance may lead to the risk of developing a problem, once given enough exposure, there's no difference. Social protection of family, of the social group, didn't make a difference. The brains were equally changed, and we need to pay attention to the changed brain when we develop strategies for treating addictions. So, addiction basically equals altered brain. These changes are long-term. In fact, in studying dopamine receptors in the human brain 227 days after last cocaine use, as the slide prior to this showed, if it could have come up appropriately, you would see that there were still dopamine changes 227 days after last cocaine use. So this notion that we have addiction treatment that can only last 28 days and should result in cure, the brain is profoundly changed for a long period of time, and we must address this change continuously. Because these changes not only relate to ongoing risk for return to drug use, but they also affect other aspects of physiology and decision-making. So our goal of treatment must be to correct these changes and to minimize the impact of these changes. I want to talk now about the pharmacological action of drugs. Drugs affect the brain, and short-acting drugs, the faster that drug gets into the brain and leaves the brain, the more it will change the brain. Think of heroin. It gets into the brain very quickly and disappears quickly. Highly addictive. Think of nicotine. Enters into the brain quickly and leaves quickly. Highly addictive. But long-acting nicotine, say in a patch, slowly entering the brain, slowly leaving the brain, is not particularly addictive. Long-acting opiates like methadone and buprenorphine are phenomenal treatments for opiate addiction. They are long-acting, slowly entering the brain, slowly leaving the brain. We know that the faster a drug enters the brain and leaves the brain, it is more likely to affect how those genes in the brain are transcribed, how the receptors and neurons function. We know they affect physiology, such as immune function, such as stress hormone response, and certainly what everyone in this room can relate to, we know they affect behavior. In this diagram of the typical use of a heroin addict, we see heroin on top, up and down, levels in the brain, frequent use throughout the day. The heroin has its onset, the heroin has its offset. That alters the brain, that alters function, that alters behavior. Eventually, tolerance is lost, and the heroin addict uses throughout the day just to try to stay normal, as they would describe it. It's not even trying to stay high. Whereas on long-acting medications, such as methadone or buprenorphine, you've got slow onset, slow offset, as depicted on the bottom. This leads to normalization in the brain. So those changes of receptor function, of hormone function, of physiology, we can follow patients who are on medication for treatment, and these normalize. Interestingly, we can follow patients who've been able to remain off of drugs, yet not on medication, and we still detect abnormalities in the brain. And we suspect that these ongoing abnormalities increase the risk for return to drug use, as often happens. So what are the goals of medication to treat addiction? Because if we are to adequately treat this disease, we must pay attention to the hundreds of millions of tax dollars spent through NIH that has devised the best treatment approaches, which is combining medications and behavioral treatments. We need to prevent withdrawal symptoms. We need to reduce craving. We need to normalize the disrupted brain and body. And of course, target the specific systems in the brain that have been affected by drugs. There are several medications approved for the treatment of drug dependence. I wish I could tell you we were further along for treatments of cocaine, methamphetamine, and marijuana dependence. The NIH has many medications in trial, and hopefully we will be there soon. But my biggest warning to you is there are no quick fixes. This is a chronic relapsing disease that will require long-term behavioral and medication management. And do not believe any quick fixes of three-day infusions or vitamins or other rapid cures that will suddenly cure an addiction. This is an ongoing process. It is a chronic disease, and I have addiction compared to some other chronic diseases that you are familiar with. When we look at patients treated with methadone for their opiate dependence, we find after a year that maybe 15 to 35% of them aren't doing well. Well, how does this compare to diabetes? Well, more than 10% drop out of diabetes treatment after the first appointment, a third after the first 6 months. In diabetes care, well, it may get better in the first 6 months. It gets worse in 40% in the second 6 months of treatment. Hypertension, that combination of diet, exercise, and medications, analogous to addiction treatment, combinations of behavioral and pharmacological interventions. Well, a quarter aren't adherent to their treatment regimen after a year, and 45% aren't adherent to their regimen after 2 years. High cholesterol, again, diet, exercise, and medication. 70% aren't following their treatment regimen after 2 years. So in comparison, our ability to treat addiction is pretty similar to other chronic diseases, yet for some reason, the addict is spurned by society and treatment is seen as non-successful. But what happens if we don't treat or we don't provide adequate combinations of medication treatment and behavioral treatment? Well, the best abstinence-based approaches for opiate addiction, for example, we find that 83% fail treatment within 2 years. That's either death, a return to drug use, or just loss to the system. What about short-term medication, 14 days to 6 months? Again, within 2 years, 80% fail. What about long-term treatment followed by gradual tapering off of medication? Well, there's a three and a half fold increased risk of death after 2 years compared to those who remain on medication and on behavioral therapy. The cost is immense to not adequately treat this with combinations of medicine and behavioral interventions. In this study of 581 heroin addicts followed for 33 years, we see that 48% of them were dead after 33 years. Was it due to old age? 33 years is a long time. Well, no. Of those deaths, 21% were due to overdose, 15% were due to liver disease, mainly because of viral hepatitis and cirrhosis, and 20% were due to a combination of murder, suicide, and accident. All of these deaths were preventable with appropriate treatment and access to treatment. And it's not just the addiction we're worried about. It's the diseases that go along with addiction. In this study of heroin addicts entering methadone maintenance, we looked at the age of entry into treatment and the chances of having viral hepatitis or HIV. This is from New York City, a study I was part of. And we see the younger a patient entered into adequate treatment, the less likely they were to be infected with hepatitis C or HIV, which means the less likely they are to develop the diseases of failed liver and immune function and to spread it to other individuals. The earlier a patient gets into treatment, the earlier a patient gets into adequate treatment, the better off their health is going to be, the better off the health of society will be. The costs aren't just medical. They aren't just criminal justice. You do have a slide on the 90% reduction in convictions following entry into treatment, but there are financial costs. So that untreated liver disease or hepatitis C that is contracted unnecessarily, when it results in cirrhosis and requires liver transplantation, we're looking at over $350,000 for a new liver, $200,000 for the last 2 years of HIV care. The costs are immense. In our program, for example, at Hennepin County Medical Center, we can provide 1 year's worth of behavioral and pharmacological treatment for heroin addiction and prescription opiate addiction and alcoholism for a little more than $4,000. The cost savings of appropriate, adequate treatment are immense. Unfortunately, there are many members of society who have problems and don't perceive the need. Close to 90% of Americans who need treatment for a substance use disorder don't understand that they need that. And in part, it is because they aren't adequately being screened for it, and they aren't being given the appropriate interventions or referral to treatment. In some part, this is due to failed perception of healthcare providers to screen. In part, it's due to access issues. We still must have parity for drug and alcohol use disorders, just as we do for other medical disorders like diabetes, like hypertension, like high cholesterol. So I want to leave you with these take-home points, that addiction is a chronic disease of the brain. It is a relapsing disease, and that we must increase our ability to screen for these diseases and refer people to treatment for these diseases. And that occasionally, just as diabetes care is complicated and goes through cycles of getting better and getting worse, so too do addictions. And occasionally people will need multiple treatments to help them in the long term. I want to emphasize that the standard of care, and again, the NIH has emphasized this through taxpayer money, that the standard of care is a combination of medication and behavioral treatments. We need to increase access to the standard of care in Minnesota. And finally, healthcare professionals need more training in their ability to diagnose, treat, or refer to treatment patients who have substance use disorders. So in the University of Minnesota Medical School, 4 years of medical education has only 4 hours of addiction-specific education. This is the number one preventable cause of death in the world, and doctors in Minnesota are only getting 4 hours of training in this. The licensed alcohol and drug counselors in the state of Minnesota, who spend a year and a half of curriculum specific to addiction, receive 0 required hours in medications used to treat addiction. That is the standard of care, and they are not receiving education adequate to this. We need to improve education and training to detect and treat and improve access so patients who are detected with these diseases can get the care that they need. Again, NIH has standards, the CDC has standards, the Institute of Medicine has standards for the treatment of various addictions. It includes medication, it includes behavioral interventions, it includes them in combination. We need to know what is the standard of care going to be in the state of Minnesota. And I am happy to answer questions. regarding any of the science related to addiction, and I know we have a very exciting panel of speakers who will further attest to the impact that addiction has on the state of Minnesota and the important changes and attention we must pay to assure that all Minnesotans and Minnesota families affected by these diseases have access to appropriate treatment. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from any of the members? The only thing that struck me as I was going through this, I mean, do you know anything about kind of what we do with kids, like in schools and stuff related? I mean, it seems like some of this information would be fairly compelling.
And, in terms of access.
And maybe you're not the person to talk about it, but about the effects of kind of the science of this, what addiction means and, you know, to them and how it will change them physiologically and all that.
I am not an expert on this. Dr. Ken Winters at the University of Minnesota does focus on areas of adolescence. What is known nationally, and this is becoming an increasing push in NIH, is that the adolescent brain is growing. It's going through rapid changes. And when we have the pharmacological alterations that drugs occur, you're taking a brain that is at its most rapid period of growth, that is during youth, and exposing it to further change that could have profound long-term effects. And yes, we need to step up our prevention efforts to keep kids away from drugs. We need to step up our ability to provide early intervention for those children who are using drugs.
And but the treatment is different in that area, I take it.
The treatment, anything related to adolescence,
yeah,
can often be more complicated.
Yeah.
And certainly the treatment is more complicated, but is available. Unfortunately, not widely enough, but there are treatment approaches specific to adolescence.
Okay. And Representative Howell, I think, has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Bart talked about the lack of training, the need for more training. What do you recommend?
So I think everyone gets nervous when it comes to mandates. I think quiet pressure to the University of Minnesota, letting them know that this is the number one preventable cause of death. Yes, there are electives available to medical students to rotate through. But I think what's become very exciting is the area of screening and brief interventions, where all healthcare professionals are able to identify and at least provide a brief, maybe 15-minute discussion with the patient to help reduce the chances of developing further problems with drugs and alcohol, and at least training physicians to know when to refer. I think one of the problems they have is they often don't know who to refer. Ultimately, there aren't enough addiction specialists in the state of Minnesota, but if we can increase the amount of curriculum to medical students. When it comes to LADCs, again, there are zero required hours on the medications used to treat addiction for it. All physicians in the state of Minnesota, all healthcare professionals in the state of Minnesota are required to maintain continuing education requirements. Again, we get very nervous about mandates, but offering more accessibility to continuing education units specific to addiction would be extremely helpful and could have a strong impact at identifying diseases. No, I don't expect every physician in the state of Minnesota to be able to treat this, but I expect every physician in the state of Minnesota to identify the problems and know when to refer to a specialist to get these problems treated.
And just as a follow-up on that, I mean, one of the things that we've been talking a lot about in the healthcare reform is a concept of a healthcare home and also like paying primary physicians more time to kind of do that work, just talking to clients. I mean, would that have an effect here?
I think it would have an effect. When I discuss, you know, I'm in the Department of Medicine, so my colleagues are primary care providers. Many of them are overwhelmed by patients with addictions because they don't feel as though they've been adequately trained. So to create the home would be very helpful, but what do we do about the career physicians who have already been in practice? They can't go, yes, we can change medical school, but they can't go back to medical school to get the training. So maybe that's where continuing education, but I do think the physicians I work with, the calls I get from around the state from family practitioners, from internists, they feel out of their league dealing with patients with addiction and spreading the word on detection, referral to treatment, making it easier for them to know how to refer. Again, parity plays a huge role. When someone is upstate and they have an addict and there is not ability to refer that patient to a treatment center when that patient doesn't have insurance, even MinCare, it is insurance, does not provide adequate treatment for alcohol and drug use disorders. Yes, we have coverage, and it's better than many of the states in this country, but it is nowhere near the level of parity that Representatives Ramstad and Kennedy have been working with for the Wellstone Bill in the U.S. Congress. We need that parity in Minnesota.
Representative Bramlett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to comment on the school question that you asked, and as Representative Walker knows, every time we try to do any topics in education besides reading, writing, arithmetic lately, we run into a little bit of trouble, but we're continuing to pursue this. There is a bill that we will consider this year and probably really consider next year when we have funding. But I would hope people in this room would become aware of it and support it, and that is a bill to have we have a model in Minnesota that actually is unique for early childhood, where we have the changing brains and parents come in and learn about how to deal with children and how to do parenting. So we have a bill that came out of the Humphrey Institute proposing that there be similar programs for parents and students in middle school years, in sixth grade through eighth grade or so, where their brains are again changing, so that parents can learn about the kind of facts that you are putting forward. So hopefully we'll get somebody from this room here to come and testify for that bill as well.
I think those bills are great, and I would emphasize or urge the committee members to utilize the great resources of Minnesota and seek out scientific advisors for these kinds of programs, so they can be shaped following the best we have in evidence-based approaches.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Barrett, thank you so much for your testimony today and the great work that you are doing on this. And when the chair first asked her questions, I almost had so many I didn't know what to say.
Uh-oh.
Don't worry. They're like Wellstone used to say, it'll be a short speech, only a couple of hours, right? First of all, I just want to say that I also serve on the Public Safety Finance Committee, where we learn an awful lot about the effect of this in the criminal justice system and therefore on the state's budget. So, I mean, this is just a huge topic. I'm also sitting on a committee, a House and Senate committee, looking at sex offender treatment, long-term treatment. And, it's just astounding how much addiction issues have to do with all of this. You know, if we could wave a magic wand and get rid of addiction, I just can't imagine how much money that would save the taxpayer. I mean, it would be huge, just from top to bottom, not just in direct expenditures, but other kinds of losses that we have. But I just wanted to ask you a couple of things. First of all, and I'll just throw them both out, and you can answer them however you want. One thing I wanted to see what your thoughts were, the effects of a person acknowledging their addiction on their treatability. The first step in AA is something about, acknowledging that I'm an alcoholic, that I have no control over alcohol. And I know there are different schools of thought about this, I think. You know, can people be treated or begin to be treated if they don't acknowledge that they're an addict? And the second thing I wanted to ask you, you had this great chart here about the effect on criminality of the methadone maintenance treatment. And I wondered if you had data from other treatment of people who are addicted to other substances, too, and the effect on criminality there.
Okay.
Dr. Park.
Your first question. recognition of a disease process is an incredibly important part of treatment. Is it a required part of treatment? No. It can, without it, it can make treatment more difficult. But there has been this notion, I think ill-conceived, and the evidence shows ill-conceived, that a patient needs to hit rock bottom before they can be amenable to treatment. It is better to intervene early before a patient hits rock bottom. Treatment can work. Yes, it can be more difficult. Maybe it takes the second or third approach for treatment before it finally takes. But intervening early, even when the patient does not have complete buy-in to the disease process that they are suffering from and that they need treatment for, may lead to a significant amount of human suffering, a reduction in human suffering and disease process, hospitalizations, liver failure, infectious diseases. Buy-in is a good thing, but we, you know, as a physician, I see it all the time. Patients aren't always ready to confront the issue that they have diabetes or they have cancer. We don't wait to treat it until they're ready. I mean, obviously, we need their approval and consent to treat it, but we work with them. Treatment is a process. It's a gradual improvement. It's not an all-or-none issue. And we can work with patients even before they are ready. In terms of your second question, give me a reminder. I'm sorry.
About effects of criminality treating other stuff.
We don't have as dramatic data, at least I don't, to show you for other diseases, but certainly the drug courts for cocaine, for methamphetamine, even for alcoholism have shown a significant reduction in repeat offense. The New England Journal of Medicine last February of 2007, I believe it was, showed that people being released from prison, the largest cause of death, and it occurred within 2 months after release, was overdose. Inadequately providing treatment in prison or inadequately providing resources for treatment upon release from prison will result not only in return to criminality but possibly death. So, for example, we find in our patients who are on methadone maintenance, let's say they're doing extremely well. They haven't used drugs for years, but they get picked up, say, on a warrant for failure of child support. They're sent to jail. The jail system and the prison system in the state of Minnesota will not allow these patients to remain on their medication. They are quickly tapered, they suffer withdrawal symptoms, and then when they are discharged, if they don't make it back to us right away, they are at risk for return to drug use and the associated problems, including death, that accompany it. So we have a long way to go with improving care within the prison system. I think some of the, again, problem courts are very helpful. And some of the new areas, Eden House, which has representation here, does have some treatment programs specific for prison release. We need to expand these. They are very helpful.
Yeah. And we have, I think, Representative Schumper and Bunn both have questions, and then I think we'll have to move on.
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Bart, how we allocate resources in the healthcare system is really the issue of the day in our society. It strikes me that it might not be the most useful allocation of resources to have primary care physicians providing counseling on substance abuse. I mean, and you mentioned that earlier, might we not have that allocated to nurse practitioners or other healthcare professionals? Might not that be a more efficient way of dealing with chemical dependency, and therefore we could make dollars go further by having more people in that? You want to comment on that?
I think the biggest bang for the buck is going to be detecting the issue. And if that's by a primary care physician, if that's by a nurse practitioner, I don't think it really matters. It's the unprotected process that's allowed to continue that has the huge economic impact. Now, I do want to clarify something. Is When it comes to approaches of primary care intervention, again, does it really matter who does it? Probably not. Is big bang for the buck, and there's lots of data for this. The state of Minnesota is working on a grant to the federal government to implement this more widely. Perhaps Carol Falkowski will discuss this later. Is if we detect issues in primary care before they become substance use disorders, before they are alcoholics, before they are drug addicts, but are still misusing at a level that could be harmful to them. So, for example, you could drink 16 drinks of alcohol a week and have no problem. 16 drinks, that's not a whole lot during the course of the week, and not be an alcoholic. But you can have increased risk for hypertension, for stroke, for arrhythmia. In women, it's associated with increased risk for breast cancer. Having a primary care provider, again, is it a physician, is it a nurse practitioner, provide education about that. But people who don't yet have the problem of addiction could serve as a preventative issue. But you're right, there needs to be more specific allocation to specialists for those with the addiction. We need to focus on detecting it. And if nurse practitioners are the ones doing it versus physicians, I'd be happy. Let's just get the disease and the problems detected.
That's a good question. Representative Bunn.
Thank you. This is actually a follow-up to Representative Thiessen's earlier comment about healthcare homes, but also Representative Schumper's remarks. It ties in with that in two parts. One is that I think I appreciate your chronic disease approach to talking about this, and obviously part of why we're moving towards thinking about healthcare homes is to better manage and coordinate care for chronic diseases of a variety of types, because and also tear down some of the silos between the medical portion and the social service portion and other aspects of that care for them ongoing. But it's one aspect of what's coming forward from the healthcare reform processes this summer on the preventive side, but also leading to this healthcare home analysis is a push in some of the recommendations to require everyone at every level of the system to fill out annual health risk assessments of a variety of kinds, whether it's young people in our schools or everyone in the healthcare system. And two parts then. So first of all, in your experience, if you have any, or anyone else that speaks later this morning, how, in terms of this early identification of people at risk, how effective implementation of statewide, real big push to have everyone at every level system fill out risk assessments either online, electronically, or in conjunction with their provider system in a more personal way, do you think it would be to identify these folks? Meaning, how truthful will the revelation of their actual behavior be if we ask them questions about how many drinks per week they have and that kind of thing? And then secondly, do you think a model that has, advanced practice nurses or other kinds of ancillary workers who have some special training in this area to work with the physician groups and also coordinate with the other social services or systems, it would be a good one for most of the people involved in this with most of the types of abuse involved? Or is there a need for really specialized, centers like Hazleton and that kind of thing still a large component of the system?
Dr. Burke.
Those are phenomenal questions. I, in terms of the universal questionnaires or computerized formats that do risk assessments, I don't know specifically about that, but I can tell you about an interesting program that's been implemented in many states. Again, this is something that Minnesota will be applying for. It's a screening and brief intervention approach. And this was done face-to-face interviews. I'll use Houston as an area. The state of Texas implemented this in the Houston area. And this was implemented through emergency rooms and primary care clinics. And every patient entering in was asked three very basic questions. Do you use tobacco products? Have you consumed five or more drinks within the last 3 months, may have been a year, I don't remember the time frame. And have you used illicit drugs such as, cocaine, misused prescription opiates, marijuana? A yes to any one of those three questions led to a more intensive screening, which then, based on that result, led to either a brief intervention, which was 15 minutes face-to-face, little education for the person who does not yet have a problem, but is at risk, or a brief treatment, maybe 6 to 12 face-to-face sessions, maybe even in group format, in which the patients maybe didn't have dependence yet, but they were having problems. Maybe they had abuse. Or a referral to specialized treatment center. 70% of the people screened out with just the three questions. So anyone could give these three questions, and it weeded out a lot of people. Then the workforce had to come in for the next level of screening, and that could be a nurse, it could be any kind of healthcare, a social worker, a physician, nursing assistant, whatever. And then the results of that could lead to the next intervention. Again, a trained healthcare professional, does it need to be a physician? Does it need to be a nurse? Does it need to be an LABC? Does it need to be a social worker? Someone who has experience is the important thing. Could handle the brief interventions or brief treatments. And then, of course, treatment as usual would need to go to a specialty provider. Much like other illnesses we deal with, your average family practitioner can treat ulcers, but when they get very complicated, you have to send them to the gastroenterologist. Well, your average practitioner can treat many substance use disorders, but when they get a little more complicated, they need to go to specialty centers. The cost savings in Houston, they followed patients, 10% of the 52,000 patients they screened, they followed them for healthcare utilization over the course of a year, and that 10% saved over $4 million in healthcare costs. Extrapolate that, that's only 10%, so to the whole group. There were decreased emergency room visits, decreased hospitalizations. Yes, there was increase in outpatient clinic utilization, but that led to better prevention, and therefore that decrease in hospitalization. So the cost savings are there to implement screening.
Well, I think that that's a good segue to our next speaker. Thank you so much. This has been really helpful and informative. We appreciate it. And thank you for all your work on this, too, in general.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. The next witness is Carol Falkowski, who I think we're really lucky to have now with us, that's working in the state of Minnesota. I know she's been in Minnesota, but she's now working for the state. So welcome to the committee.
Hi, thank you. And I was glad that, thank you so much for being here today, and I'm also glad that Dr. Bart mentioned that proposal that we're looking at. It's called Screening, Brief Intervention, and Referral to Treatment, and it's the wave of the future in terms of identifying people who are having consequences related to drug and alcohol abuse but don't meet the diagnosis of addiction. And in our continuum of care in this state and in other states, we really don't know what to do with those folks. And having these that are proven to be so cost effective is really a way to figure out what are we going to do. It's sort of like a prolonged intervention. So I'm glad you mentioned that. What I'm going to talk about is sort of a very quick overview of what we know about substance abuse treatment in the state of Minnesota. I think it's always important to point out, when you talk about substance abuse, how substance abuse here compares with other states. And the very first graph, the point of that is simply to say that when we compare ourselves to other states, we tend to be a little bit higher in alcohol use and binge alcohol use, a little bit higher in marijuana use, and then about plus with other states in terms of cigarette use, and a little bit down from other states in terms of illegal drug use. If we drill down and look at binge drinking, which certainly in light of the wave of deaths of young women that we've seen recently in our state, it's interesting to look at the cluster of states, North Dakota, South Dakota, or North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa, and we are among the top states in terms of binge drinking, which is defined as 5 or more drinks in a row by men and 4 or more by women. So it's not just the perception here. All sorts of different measures that look at drinking say that we have higher binge drinking rates. I think Dr. Bart covered very well why some people get addicted and others do not. It's a combination of genetics and environment. And one of the biggest environmental factors comes from the National Longitudinal Epidemiological Study, which looked at 43,000 people in the course of their lifetime and asked them about their drinking and drugging. and it found that people who first started drinking before the age of 15, 40% of them developed the disease of alcoholism in the course of their lifetime, whereas people who started drinking later when they were older at the ages of 21 and 22, it was only 10%. So this research really is why the primary focus of prevention in this state is on delaying the age of first use of alcohol. It fits into why we see people drinking excessively and power drinking in college. It has to do with, we know the brain doesn't fully develop, and particularly the impulse control part of the brain, until the mid-20s. And really, this research informs that. I'd also like to say that through the State Alcohol and Drug Abuse Agency, we fund prevention programs that in the last fiscal year reached over 2.3 million Minnesotans. All right. I'm probably going to skip over these because these are not only in your handouts, but they're also in a report that we just wrote. These are the principles of what good addiction treatment is, based on 20 years of research from the National Institute on Drug Abuse. To just briefly hit what I think are some of the highlights, one is that treatment needs to be readily available. There are many different approaches to treatment. No single treatment is appropriate for all individuals. One of Dr. Bart's slides that showed how methadone treatment reduces criminality is because there's a great deal of research on that, because methadone treatment was first devised as a way to reduce crime. It was a crime control strategy. So there is a lot of research on the effects on crime. But there is no one treatment fits all. We also know that effective treatment needs to address all the needs of people, not just their drug and alcohol abuse. So in that sense, the charge of addiction treatment is bigger than the charge of treatment for other diseases, because you're asking that all the areas of the life of a person, of an addict that has been diminished by their addiction, we say are now within the purview of treatment to address. So that's vocational services, mental health services, financial services, legal services. We also know that of people coming into addiction treatment these days, about 60% also have co-occurring mental health disorders. So there's that added scope of what is effective addiction treatment. And so this really is another aspect that makes it unlike other chronic diseases. You don't treat with someone for hypertension and then follow up 6 months later and say, and how's that job hunt going? You know, I mean, you're expected with addiction treatment to address all these areas of a person's life. We know that there's individual and group counseling. Medications are an important element of treatment. And we know that treatment does not need to be voluntary in order to be effective. When I worked at Hazelden, they used to say people get better because they feel the heat, not because they see the light, necessarily. And this has to do with most people, when they finally get addiction treatment, are there because of pressure from the criminal justice system, their family, or their employer. And it's spread out equally. About 33% of people who come to treatment, come from each one of those pressure points. We also know, and let me just go back to this, that remaining in treatment for an adequate period of time is critical to treatment effectiveness. What the science says is it's about 90 days of treatment engagement is where you see significant improvement, 90 days. We also know that participation in self-help groups as an adjunct to treatment and during treatment helps maintain long-term drug-free sobriety, and that recovery is a long-term process, and for many people, more than one treatment episode is what they experience. This is another variation on what the doctor already presented. This looks at relapse rates between drug addiction and other chronic illnesses based on an analysis of multiple studies presented by the Journal of the American Medical Association. So you see the relapse rate with addiction, 40 to 60% of folks will relapse, and how that compares with diabetes, hypertension, and asthma. Based on this, we know that drug addiction needs to be treated like any other chronic illness, and relapse serves as a trigger for renewed intervention. Now, this of all the graphs and things I'm talking about today, I think this is the most interesting, because this is the most contrary to public perception in Minnesota. This looks at clients in treatment per 100,000 population. people 18 and older in treatment. It's a population-based rate, so there's no difference for larger states or smaller states. You divide it by the population. And you can see from this national graph that we're in the lighter end of that. But when we look at this broken down state by state, look at where Minnesota is. We are third from the bottom in the country in terms of clients in treatment per 100,000 population. I think whenever we hear the phrases like Minnesota, the land of 10,000 treatment centers, we hear mini sober, we hear little catchphrases like that, that it creates a false impression. I think most people, as I was surprised, to see where Minnesota ranks in terms of the number of people. I think we have this perception somehow that everyone is in treatment in Minnesota, and this is clearly not the case. Why are we here? I think there's some things that contribute to it. I can't stand before you today and tell you it's because of this, 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 and this. It's definitely something that we're looking into. And I think one of the things, if there are barriers to people getting access to treatment when they need it, that's something that we're addressing through the revision of our Rule 25 that's coming up here shortly, which is the gateway for public clients to access treatment. But I just don't think this is where providers and people concerned with the health and well-being of Minnesotans perceive us to be or want us to remain. If we look at admissions to treatment, how many people come into treatment in Minnesota? We see how it's gone up gradually since the year 2000, and now there are about 48,000 treatment admissions a year. But when the last time we did a statewide study of who qualifies and meets the diagnosis for who's dependent in the state compared to who actually receives treatment, it is about 7% of people in Minnesota who qualify for a diagnosis of addiction or abuse that actually receive treatment. It is true that nationwide it is an undertreated disorder for a variety of reasons, but here in Minnesota it's 7%, and this preceding chart really reflects sort of the saturation that we're doing, which I think there's need for improvement. If we look at it by different substances of abuse, this next graph looks at it by drug, a primary drug of abuse for people coming into treatment. You can see alcohol accounts for the lion's share. About 50% of all admissions are alcohol as the primary drug. You see marijuana. You can see how methamphetamine-related treatment admissions rose and have been declining since 2005. You can see cocaine is up a little, how heroin has been gradually going up, as well as other opiates. But this is my favorite snapshot of how different drugs of abuse compare with each other in terms of people receiving treatment. Does this mean that the methamphetamine problem is gone? Not at all. There's still 983 offenders in our state correctional system who are there because of meth offenses. And most of those people will be released before their time comes up to receive a treatment within that system. But this is certainly encouraging because at the same time this is going down, we see meth labs going down. We see other indicators declining related to methamphetamine, which is not to say we're out of the woods, but 20 years ago when cocaine was captured the headlines like methamphetamine does now, we never really saw declines like we're seeing with methamphetamine. Cocaine just sort of leveled off and that's increasing. So I think this is very encouraging. This is looking at it at another way by whether people live in greater Minnesota or outstate Minnesota or the metro area. And that purple dotted line that you can't see in the black and white copies, but the one that goes up and then goes down again, is methamphetamine. And you can see, again, changes from the turn of the century till now. This is the big pie. Look, again, just looking at it a different way, alcohol accounts for about half of treatment admissions, marijuana 17.6%, and then the same percentage statewide for cocaine and methamphetamine. But bear in mind that, you know, 8 years ago, that methamphetamine slice really was about 2%, so it has increased significantly, even though it's going down.
And how does this compare to what, you know, you say 7% of people actually get into treatment? I mean, would the chart look similar if we're actually saying who has problems that should be treated in each of these areas, or would alcohol be much bigger piece of that life?
Alcohol would be a much of who actually has problems, because so many more people use alcohol than use illegal drugs. 60% of the population uses alcohol, and it's a much smaller percent who use drugs.
And I guess what I'm asking is, are we, when we talk about the 7%, are we getting a lot more than 7% for some of these other drugs and a lot lower for alcohol that actually get into treatment, or is that hard to say?
No, it's in the report that was written, and as I recall it, people with a drug addiction were slightly more likely to receive treatment than people with an alcohol addiction. I think that's what you're asking.
Yes, that's a better way. That is what I was asking.
Okay.
Okay.
I mean, that.
Oh, and Representative Walker.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along those lines, I know I have some constituents who said that they have difficulty getting into treatment with the beds that have crack addictions. And so along those lines, Mr. Chair, are we still not getting to the true number when the beds aren't available, or the increasing beds for meth have taken precedent or more priority in some treatment centers versus cocaine and crack?
You know, that's an interesting issue, and I am really not aware of having designated beds for certain drugs. I don't think that necessarily happens. I think that the delays in accessing treatment are kind of uniform, regardless of what the primary drug is for the person. It is different when we talk about opiate addiction, and we do have limited capacity for methadone services, the medication for opiate addiction, in different parts of the state.
President Walker?
Yeah, or maybe I'm not getting answer.
You know, I guess I'm not sure if you'll be able to answer this. Wondering, you know, while there may not be a designate for beds, there's still a process that one would go through when they go to a treatment center coming in for help. Mm-hmm. And whether beds are available, you fit the criteria depending on if it's faith-based or otherwise. You know, the organization still has to say if someone's coming in. I'm curious to know, is there any data as it relates to how many of these individuals are reoccurring addicts getting treatment versus first-time addicts, especially as it relates to the meth versus alcohol and or cocaine?
Yes, there is, but I don't have it right here. Right.
So maybe we can send that to us, and we'll get that out to people.
Yep. Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. This goes on to look at just gender differences by different drugs for people receiving treatment. I'll skip through this. There are also some age differences. Basically, people entering treatment for marijuana tend to be at the young end of the spectrum, with 70% of them are under the age of 25. I think that's a pretty striking figure. Whereas if you look at people coming in for cocaine and heroin and alcohol, it tends to be an older population, with the majority of folks being over the age of 35. Here's some differences in who enters treatment in our state by race, ethnicity. You can see whites are disproportionately represented among methamphetamine admissions. You can see African Americans disproportionately represented in cocaine admissions and heroin admissions, and some other differences there. And this is really what I want to spend a little bit of time on, because, you know, I think committees like yours, policymakers, don't always see what they're getting, what kind of bang for the buck are you getting when you pay for treatment. It is well documented that it's not an inexpensive proposition, but what are you really getting? And this looks at performance outcome measures of people as a result of treatment. These indicators are collected referring to the 30 days before a person got into treatment, and then looking at the 30 days when they get discharged from treatment. And you can see how all of these areas of a person's life improve. This is based on looking at 19,000 treatment admissions in the state of Minnesota who came into treatment between January and June of 2007 and were discharged as of November 1st of 2007. So it's a big chunk of people. You can see how there's been a decline in homelessness. You can see how there's been an increase in the percentage of people who are employed or students. You can see how there's been a decline in arrests. This speaks to different data, not methadone specific, about reduced criminality as a result of treatment. You can see how there's been a decline in alcohol use, a decline in illegal drug use, and you can see how there's been an increase in the percentage of people who are engaged in self-help groups, which again have been shown to increase people's likelihood of maintaining drug-free long-term sobriety. And you can see that there's been an increase in people who have family support for their recovery. So this is just one set of performance outcome measures that document the effectiveness of addiction treatment in the state of Minnesota. Another set I want to talk about are chemical health severity ratings. And again, these are severity ratings that are going to be incorporated into this Rule 25 assessment, which again is the gateway into the public treatment system. And from that gateway, people are actually assigned to treatment programs. They don't get to choose what treatment program they go to. They get assigned based on the placing authority, which in this state is the county. And you can see, again, these are the percent of patients with problems that are moderate, severe, or extreme in these different areas of functioning. So you can see at admission to treatment compared to discharge from treatment, there's a decline in the percentage of people who have intoxication or withdrawal problems. You'd expect that. Also a decline in biomedical problems, a decline in emotional and behavior problems at treatment compared to discharge. Readiness to change is also problems with that have declined. There are fewer problems with people not being ready to change. And relapse potential. Look at that difference. And again, that's what you would expect with effective treatment going on. And also there's fewer people who have problems with their recovery environment. And again, that's because part of the charge of treatment is to get people in supported living situations after treatment so that they have support for drug-free sober living. And you can see, looking at it even another way, that all of these indicators of effective treatment are moving in the right direction and some of these increases in patients. So with that, I thank you for your time, and I would just like to open up for any questions. These are, again, sort of the big picture issues.
Reverend Walker.
I'm curious to know, do we know, just there are so many different models now that we have for treatment centers, whether it's outpatient, inpatient, large scale, small scale. And while we have either, for most of them, for many of them, the 21 to 28 days, are we looking, is there any research that's showing the outcome and the differences between the 21 days to 28 days and those that are able to fund privately with longer stays for inpatient or even outpatient care?
Not that we have done specifically in Minnesota. And the thing that complicates that is this. There is no standard of what is outcome. These outcome measures, these performance outcome measures, are nationally required of all states, and they're relatively new. This is the first year, in fact, that we've been able to do these statewide. But in terms of drilling down that far into outcome measures and having any sort of industry standard on what constitutes successful treatment is an emerging field. There is no standard, so I'm not aware of those studies existing, certainly not within the state of Minnesota. That said, going back to the principles of addiction treatment, there really is a strong science base for people who have looked at what studies do exist to say the longer the duration of treatment, the better the outcome. And there seems to be a breaking point at about 90 days that treatment that does not engage a person for shorter than that may not be effective. That said, even though we do have a lot of programs, if they're residential, that are 28 days, many of them involve the patient longer than that in structured aftercare activities, so that 90 days may be being met. But there's certainly more to be known about this, absolutely.
Mr. Chair, to follow up, are there anyone that's working on those, developing those standards? I'm just thinking about the many different testimonies that we had, especially around meth, and particularly from Teen Challenge, and some of the outcomes that they received with individuals coming in addicted, and the follow-up that they've been able to have past 18 months, even going into 24 months.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. one of the things that I've noticed, because they come with so much compelling testimony, members get really excited about that possibility and want to even come up with funding for that model. But it's still usually dealing with the meth addiction that is has been recently so devastating to so many communities. But there still doesn't seem to be a lot of focus on some of the other addictions, going back to crack and alcohol. And so I'm just wondering if there's anyone out there trying to work on these standards. If we believe that we need more than 28 days, where's the standards to come to the legislature so we can do, not only fund, but push that policy forward?
Mm-hmm. Well, you've raised a number of issues. One of them is about the duration of treatment. Depending on different drugs of abuse, and when I was the director of research communications at Hazelden for the past decade, did a lot of testimony in Washington at both the House and the Senate side for Senator Coleman about the efficacy and effectiveness of treatment for methamphetamine addiction. And it really was, sitting next to the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, the clear message we kept delivering in different venues was that addiction is treatable, even methamphetamine addiction is treatable. And simply because methamphetamine was the drug, it did not necessarily mean that in all cases you needed to have a longer duration of treatment exposure. That said, we are looking in this state at developing a more flexible model of treatment, and we're doing that through the Rule 25 assessment and our revision of Rule 31, which defines what treatment is, so that we can more effectively put together a package of services that treat the individual aspects of a person's problem based on these dimensions and in this slide up here. And rather than having a patient that presents and trying to say, okay, now what program do you fit into, just looking at what the patient presents with and saying, what package of services do we need to put together, and making more flexibility so we can have better outcomes, absolutely.
Can you just briefly tell us what Rule 25 and Rule 31 are?
Yeah, Rule 31 is the licensing that determines who can deliver addiction treatment in the state. And Rule 25 is the gateway. It sets the rules for who gets consolidated chemical dependency treatment funding in the state. It's a state-funded, county-administered program, so the counties are the placing authorities. And one of the reasons that we are in the process of revising Rule 25 is because we revised 31 a couple years ago, but 25 is being revised so that regardless of where you live in the state, whether it's Mora or Matamidi or Minnetonka or whatever, Mankato, that you get the same uniform treatment and placement regardless of where you live. It's the system came up 20 years ago, and this is the first major, you know, improvement of it since then. So, and again, I think using this grid and the one you have in front of you that has these different severity ratings by level of severity, is really cutting edge and similar to other dimension severity things that are being used in other parts of the country and by different professionals.
And does that Rule 25 revision, is that going to get at the issue of kind of the disparity? Does that get at how funds flow, the formula that funds flow to the counties? Or is that separate?
That is a whole, the maintenance of effort that counties, we have a system where the state funds, the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund, is also matched by a maintenance of effort by counties. And that was also devised 20 years ago, and it has a situation now where some counties pay 15% and some pay much more and some pay much less. And that is a broken part of it. We hope to get that addressed as well. In addition to that, since the whole system of public funding in the state has a number of exceptions based on the changing needs of the patients we see, the higher prevalence of mental disorders, you know, they seem to be a lot farther down the addiction pike before they get treatment, we are going to develop by the October of this year, we're going to get the best thinkers about how to publicly fund treatment together and come up with what we think is an optimal an optimal method of doing it, because there are a number of exceptions now that just aren't working, and this maintenance of effort hasn't been addressed, even though it's been up in front of the legislature for a number of years. It's really complicated. You've stepped through those. So we hope to get that addressed as well.
But we can do. You can do the Rule 25 revision separate from that.
Yep. And that's going, and it's public hearing is February 1st out of the gate.
Rosanna Levin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I have a lot of questions, but I'm going to try and contain myself here. First of all, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about this last chart that we have that you've been talking about quite a bit, because it's a little confusing to me, this chemical health severity ratings by dimension.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't have to be sold on the idea that we need to, that there's real value in giving people treatment. I mean, I accept that premise. But, I mean, some of this is confusing to me. First of all, intoxication withdrawal. If, you know, we're talking about a comparison between people who have that issue at admission versus at discharge, why wouldn't that be zero? When people are being, maybe I'm not understanding what is being represented here, but I would expect that people at the point of discharge from treatment would not be either intoxicated or going through withdrawal still.
Right.
So that's my first question. And then let me just run through them real quickly. The other one I have with this is relapse potential, which I don't understand what that would be. So.
Okay. The first one is some drugs like benzodiazepines really have long windows of withdrawal. This looks at all patients. It's their first blush that we've done it. I kind of rushed to put this together so I could have something that really shows that we're measuring treatment outcomes. But it includes people who may have had a two-week interval of treatment. It includes people who may have had longer. And that withdrawal period can be prolonged. So that's the simple reason. That's the quickest answer. Then in terms of relapse potential, unlike the chart that preceded this, this is the percentage of people who report moderate, severe, or extreme problems in the area of relapse potential. So this says that 84% of the people, when they present to treatment, have had trouble with relapse, that they're high risk for relapsing. Part of treatment is to reduce the likelihood that they'll relapse. So we see a decline in that. But some people, you know, treatment is a work in progress. It's not, as Dr. Bart said, some people need repeated treatment episodes, and some people, you know, they're still at high risk even when they leave treatment. You know, there's different prognosis, and part of that prognosis, again, depends on the characteristics of the person and the severity and intensity of their illness.
You follow up, Mr. Chair. Okay, and I guess going back to the intoxication withdrawal part, I guess that maybe that what I'm getting from your answer is that maybe some people aren't getting a long enough treatment, right? Because I find it kind of strange that, you know, you'd be discharged. I understand what you're saying, but so we're discharging some people who are still withdrawing from the drug. That doesn't seem like a terribly smart thing to be doing, discharging them from treatment when they're not even done with their withdrawal. And then the second piece, I guess, I'm still a little not clear about what relapse potential is or how you're measuring it, but I don't want to spend any more time with that, but I do think that's something that needs to be clarified. But then
the report that you have that is the longer one, these are just the slides from it, elaborates on both those points.
Okay, thank you. And if I could just move quickly to another question, and that is on your this chart that you have about clients and treatment per 100,000 by state, you know, I'm sure that's kind of shocking to all of us. We're not used to being so close to the bottom on anything here in Minnesota.
No, it depends on sensibilities as Minnesota.
It does. And, but I wonder about the way the state is represented because, this is, it doesn't have anything in it about need. And so I wonder, you know, if there's some kind of need adjustment that could be done to this chart that would show us, you know, I mean,
well, I don't think it's happening because Minnesotans don't need treatment. I mean, that's what someone said. Well, it's just that we don't need treatment. We have as much treatment need as any state. And, in fact, in terms of our alcohol abuse, we're at the top of the scale. You know, we aren't. And granted, there's more to addiction than just a lot of drug or alcohol use. But I don't think this reflects a lack of need of treatment. We have no reason to believe that Minnesotans are less needy of addiction services than people in other states. I think this reflects that we just don't have the coverage that other states do in terms of providing treatment, in spite of our rich history of quality treatment and our long history of providing treatment.
Okay, I guess then that raises the question, you know, why? Why are we so far down, you know?
Right, that's something that we are going to be looking into and trying to come up with more insight into that.
And then just a really brief comment on your race adjusted, or your race, the one by race here, which mm-hmm. I'm not finding right here, but... I guess just a comment on that. Sometimes it's useful. I mean, it's kind of, we like to see things broken out by race a lot of times or by ethnicity, but it's not really meaningful to me to see this because you don't know, it doesn't reflect, it's not population adjusted for the races in our state, you know. So I guess that would be more helpful to see, rather than just percentage of users of a certain drug who belong to a certain ethnic group.
Okay, these are people in treatment, but
yeah.
Well, it's maybe just adding another column that shows the population in the state, right? And then you could make some comparison.
Well, yeah, but you can make statistical adjustment based on those percentages. You know, we often see age-adjusted figures. You could see a population-adjusted figure that would just give us a clearer picture of what we're seeing here. Would be very helpful.
Great, thanks.
Well, thank you very much. This has been very helpful. William Moyer, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for including my perspective in this. I wouldn't say it's an unprecedented hearing, but it certainly is a hearing that we don't see very often here at the legislature in terms of the quality of focus and the depth by which you've given the time to make this happen today. So thank you for including me, and also to Carol Falkowski, who's was my former colleague at Hazelden and who was a great champion for the needs of people who come from all parts of our state. I'm glad that she is in the position that she's in now, although we certainly miss her at Hazelden. It would be easy for me to take part in today's hearing from my perspective as a representative of the Hazelden Foundation, where I work. It's easy, I say, because Hazelden is an organization that many of you know about, and our reputation speaks for itself. We're very good at helping people and their families and their communities overcome the devastating illness of addiction to alcohol and other drugs. Hazelden was founded 59 years ago today on a farm in Chisago County as a place that was initially started to treat drunk priests from the Twin Cities. And while much has changed in the area over the decades, Hazelden's mission hasn't changed at all. We treat addiction. We transform lives. We help to forge what is known around the world now as the Minnesota model of treatment, and most facilities in this state use that model in one way, shape, or form to treat thousands of people every year. And so I could talk to you this morning about addiction treatment recovery from this perspective as a senior executive at Hazelden, but that would defeat the real purpose of my role here today. And to put that role into perspective, let me first share a couple of things with you. I pay state and federal income taxes, and I contribute to Social Security because I have the ability to work and hold a job. I pay property taxes, which are always going up, because I am able to own a home in the Crocus Hill neighborhood of St. Paul. I am an engaged father of three teenage children. I've been a Rotarian, a community volunteer, and I've served on the boards of many organizations, including the Minnesota Humanities Commission, Boys and Girls Club, the Metropolitan State University, and Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. I have also been on the board of the Park Midway Bank. And also, in addition to all those things, I vote. And sometimes I actually vote for winners. And so I'm able to do all of those things because, and despite an illness that once prevented me from working or obeying the law or paying taxes or being a responsible neighbor and a responsible father. My illness is called alcoholism. My illness is called drug dependence. Yes, I am an addict and an alcoholic. This is what one looks like. But I'm in long-term recovery today. Why? Because I got treatment. Treatment not once, treatment not twice, treatment not three times, four times. Four times over 5 years I needed treatment between 1989 and 1994. It was in treatment that I finally was given the opportunity to take personal responsibility for living with my chronic disease as a man in long-term recovery, and I have been clean and sober one day at a time since 1994. If I leave you with any message today, it is that treatment works and recovery is possible. And that when people like me get well, the entire community, this entire state, benefits from treatment. That this entire state benefits from recovery in people like me. But there is one other message that I hope you will hear today, and it's a message that I hope you hear in telling you some of my story. The message is this: addiction does not discriminate. Addiction does not discriminate. I'm a prime example of that. My parents certainly didn't raise me to become an addict and an alcoholic. They loved me, and they loved me unconditionally. My parents did everything in their power, everything they could, to give me everything good. I lacked for nothing financially. I lacked for nothing emotionally. I lacked for nothing morally. I knew the difference between right and wrong. You know, I never even lacked for anything spiritually. Some of you who may know my father, the journalist Bill Moyers, you know him as a journalist perhaps. You may know him as Lyndon Johnson's chief of staff and press secretary in the 1960s. You may know him as the man who helped to set up the Peace Corps in 1961. But the reality is that in 1959, when I was born, my father was an ordained Southern Baptist minister. And so I didn't lack for belief in a power greater than myself. So I lacked for nothing morally, financially, emotionally, or spiritually. My parents didn't raise me to become addicted. And it's not something that I aspired to do when I was a kid growing up. Who does? I wanted to be a news reporter or an airline pilot or an archaeologist. I was a captain of the track team in high school, and I was a starting tight end on the championship football team. I was the editor of the high school yearbook. I had the same girlfriend for 3 years in a row. I played trombone in the band and in the orchestra. I graduated in 1977 from high school with a B-plus average. Becoming an addict and an alcoholic isn't something I certainly aspired to do when I pursued a college degree. I was an honor student in my major, which was journalism. I did a weekly radio show, and I wrote a sports column for the school newspaper, and I graduated from Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia in 1981 with a Bachelor of Arts degree in journalism. But, like a lot of other young people, I experimented with mood and mind-altering substances. Never could I have imagined that my casual use of marijuana at age 16, when I was in high school in a quiet, safe community in New York, or my legal use of alcohol when I was a college student in Virginia, where I learned to binge drink. Never could I have imagined that those experimentations would ever lead me down the abyss of hopelessness, despair, and to several near-death experiences. But that's what happened. Why? Well, because as Dr. Bart so easily and effectively explained, I have a brain that processes alcohol and other drugs differently than 90% of the rest of the population of wherever we come from. I'm glad that Dr. Bard explained it better than I ever could. And having a brain that processes alcohol and other drugs is not an excuse. It's not an excuse for what happened to me. I take responsibility for ingesting illegal and legal substances into my body. But having the brain that I have is an explanation as to why good people can do bad things under the influence. It explains why moral people do immoral things. It's why rational people do irrational things. Yes, I am proof that addiction does not discriminate. And that's one reason why I wanted to share my story with you today, to put a human face on Dr. Bart's PET scans, to put a human face on Carol Falkowski's bar graphs. Addiction doesn't care if you live in North Minneapolis or on the east side of St. Paul. Addiction doesn't care whether you're from a farming community in Bryceland or a fisherman on the reservation on Lake Mille Lacs. Addiction doesn't care whether your party is the DFL or the Republicans. Addiction doesn't care whether you're a Jew or a Christian or a Muslim or don't believe in God at all. Addiction doesn't care at all. Addiction doesn't discriminate. And neither should our public policy in Minnesota discriminate against people like me. As Bob Nelson from Mark will tell you in a few minutes, we need a balanced approach to how we deal with this problem. Interdiction and tough law enforcement won't work by themselves unless we also add resources for prevention, residential or outpatient treatment, drug courts, sober housing and aftercare services that promote and sustain recovery. Yes, addiction is a chronic illness. Yes, the relapse rate is what it is. But the reality is that when people like me take personal responsibility and get access to treatment sometimes more than once, we can and we do recover. And I'm very heartened to find out that we're having this conversation in the committee that we're having in today, a committee that focuses on health and human services and not just law enforcement and the legal system. And I think that's one of the messages I want to leave you with today, that addiction does not discriminate. But I want you to know this too. Addiction doesn't discriminate, and neither should recovery. People like me should not be the exception. People like me, people who need and deserve help, should be the rule in Minnesota. Whether at Hazelden or RS Eden or Project Turnabout or Turning Point, or any of the other treatment programs I've represented in March or in this room today. People should get the same opportunities that I got, even if it means treatment more than once. In the end, that's who I represent here today. I don't represent Hazelden. I don't even represent me. What I'm really here today is to represent, to be a face and a voice of recovery on behalf of those who have no voice, on behalf of those who have no hope, no help, and no healing. I'm here today on behalf of the still suffering addicts and alcoholics and their families. I'm here on behalf of your constituents. Addiction doesn't discriminate, and neither should recovery. We know that the stakes are high, but I hope you'll also know, too, that so too are the rewards. Thank you.
Thank you very much. For your very compelling testimony. Does anybody have any questions? Thank you for coming today. That was really, that's very helpful to us. And an important message, I think, is we go forward. Bob Nelson. And please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, everyone. Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank everybody for your attention to this issue. My name is Bob Nelson. I'm the current president of the March Association, which is the Minnesota Association for Resources Recovering Chemical Health. I've been working on this issue for, most of my life now that I think about it, in one capacity or another. But most recently, I've worked with the Department of Human Services, Department of Health, working on rewriting Rule 31, rewriting Rule 25, so that our treatment programs can be more individualized, more effective, have more flexibility in the time involved to engage people, and keep people in treatment, engaged in treatment, until such time as they're ready to be discharged. I was also part of the training cadre for Department of Human Services to train license holders to make the change to treatment planning under Rule 31, which is closely aligned with the six dimensions that ASAM has developed, the Addiction Society, Society of Addiction Medicine. Through my involvement in state policy and also my work on Minnesota Join Together, which is a prevention organization attempting to keep alcohol away from youth access to alcohol, I've had the opportunity to work with very committed, creative, from people from every area that deal with this disease and the problem. Frontline people, school providers, DWI task force members, MAD, county and state administrators, and as an alcohol and drug counselor who's worked in detox, inpatient, halfway house, an outpatient, I know the people themselves who suffer the ravages of chemical dependency and see what it does to their lives, what it takes from them, what it erases from their lives on a daily basis. Good There are some good things. Minnesota has mostly a privately owned and operated treatment system which quickly responds to needs. Treatment is evidenced by the recent number of providers that have developed state-of-the-art methamphetamine treatment and made a huge impact on methamphetamine treatment in the state of Minnesota. Treatment is available across the state of Minnesota. This is directly related to the Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund, which provides a base of funding for people in every area across the state. This has been done by a lot of work by people in the legislature, by people at the Department of Human Services, and by providers. Chemical dependency is a disease. We've heard that from Dr. Bart. We've heard that from Carol Falkowski. It's closely linked with health care. The health care problems are multiplied when people are using chemicals, along with many of the other problems. Dr. Mark Willenbring said at a training that I went to over at the Veterans Hospital that if we treated chemical dependency like we treated high blood pressure and high cholesterol, we would never treat anyone until after their first stroke or heart attack. I'd like you to think about that a little bit. That's pretty shocking when you start thinking about it. But most of the time, we treat chemical dependency only after a person has suffered a significant crisis in their life. I'd like to echo what Dr. Bart said about early intervention and people doing early screening. Like with almost all health problems, the sooner we intervene, the better outcome you get. Okay? Just makes sense, doesn't it? When you say that, gee, the sooner you intervene, the better it gets. Well, all the research says that too. The sooner you intervene and the sooner you engage people in treatment, the better off you're going to be. The idea that recovery programs don't work, just factually not true. Okay? We know that. You all know examples from people in your home district, okay, of people who are in recovery. Okay? You all do. Some of them are pretty invisible, however, because a lot of them just get jobs, go to work, live at home, go home at night, sleep in their own bed, pay their taxes, don't cause any problems. So you don't even see them. But that doesn't mean they're not in recovery. They are. Through my work with Department of Human Services on the committees, teaching, March, all the things, I've come up with several areas that really need attention from the state of Minnesota. The first one was brought up a little bit earlier, fixing the formula for county maintenance of effort costs. The formula was set in 1987, does not accurately reflect the needs of the different areas of the state of Minnesota. It's resulted in uneven availability of treatments from county social service agencies. As Ms. Falkowski said, we are working to address that issue by changing the Rule 25 assessment process so that assessments across the state of Minnesota will be available. There's still an issue from county social service administrators and county boards. Where's the money? Where's the money? One of the interesting things was when we had a hearing on expanding the eligibility, the counties testified actually in favor of it, but they didn't have the money to go follow through with it. They recognize, because they see the people all the time, that there are people who do not meet the income eligibility guidelines and therefore don't get treatment until such time as they get arrested.
And can you just spend 30 seconds explaining the kind of changes since the turn of the new century on what we've done with those guidelines? In terms of, we're at 100% that you qualify now, and right. And prior to 2003 it was at?
It's been 100% for several years now. I'm not sure of exactly the time. But we used to have Tier 2 eligibility,
right.
And that went away during, I believe, some of the budget crises that we have been through. And therefore, a person making more than, I think it's around $8,000 a year, does not qualify for treatment. Now, you think of the constituents that live in your home, that in your home district, that make more than $8,000 a year, they don't qualify for any state-funded treatment. Okay? That's a pretty small amount of money. Okay? And when you think about how chemical use affects people socially and financially, Those are exactly the people we should be putting in treatment, because they are still working. They still do have homes. They still do have families and means of support in the community. But lots of times we don't fund them for treatment until such time as they no longer have jobs, or they're incarcerated, or they don't have a place to live anymore because their chemical dependency has erased that from their lives. Okay?
Yeah, thank you. That, I think, is just helpful for people to get a sense of.
But fixing the maintenance of effort is a really important part of that, because it will help to level the playing field. Detox funding is another area that needs some attention. Detox funding has developed from a partnership between the state and local funding into an all-property tax-funded regime. Every penny that goes to detox at this point in time is funded by property taxes. This has resulted in several counties paying a much larger detox per capita cost than other counties. Additionally, detox is not readily available in all areas of the state. My suggestion for that, having worked in detox and worked with many of the detox providers across the state, is not a state detox system, but a local detox system where the state participates in some of the funding somehow. One idea when we were working on the change for the MOA and the CCDTF was to have what the county spend on detox be part of their maintenance of effort. And the reason that would work is there are an awful lot of the counties that spend a pretty significant amount of money on detox, and they also have very high maintenance of effort. Expanding the income eligibility for state funding when Tier 2 was eliminated, as Representative Thiessen brought up, many people with jobs and housing and families were eliminated for funding and able access to treatment. We do have a bill currently in, 165% of poverty, which would raise that to, I think, around $16,000 a year. Again, the counties testified in favor of that, but didn't have the money. So how do we do all this? What we found out today so far is that chemical dependency is a disease. Treatment works. It's effective. It's effective, as effective as other health treatments for chronic long-term diseases. Okay? And with William Moyers testify, you have somebody in front of you that's in recovery, that's an extremely contributing member of our society. So how do we do some of this? My suggestion is to increase the tax on alcohol. The tax on alcohol was last adjusted in 1988. The lack of an increase in over two decades has effectively decreased the cost of alcohol in relation to other products. And I heard there was actually an ad on television about that, okay, which kind of blew my mind. It's not indexed for inflation. The current costs are borne on fairly by all Minnesotans, according to the Department of Health study, and I think you have a copy of it. Lots of times when I start out talking, I will ask my audience, so how much did you spend on alcohol last year? And several people go, oh, I didn't spend anything. And I go, no, you spent $900 last year. Some people get a little incensed about that. But it's not a good way to spend our money. We have better ways. Raising the price of alcohol is a prevention effort for youth in and of itself. All the research says that raising the price of alcohol will have an effect on the most price-sensitive area of our population, which are youth. College age, high school age, the binge drinking that we see. Okay? Now, I'm not naive enough to think that nobody under 21 or nobody under 25 will ever drink too much again. At the same time, when you look at the huge population, decreasing the use of alcohol will save lives, will save problems, will save people from having lifelong problems that create issues for them throughout their whole life. As you probably know, Senators Murphy and Marty have authored legislation to increase the alcohol excise tax, and though it's dubbed a tax, it truly is a user fee. One view is that a nickel, or better yet, a dime, in the excise tax would provide the treatment revenue to increase the funding to 165% of poverty and to equalize the maintenance of effort. Let's see. A user fee aimed at prevention, youth access, young drinkers, binge drinking, college age, all the research says that it will have an impact, assuming the industry chooses to pass it on. Okay? It's collected at the wholesale level. It's not directly collected at the tab by the bartender. It's collected at the wholesale level on distributors and wholesalers. I'm not aware of any of them going out of business or leaving the state. Whether the tax is passed is up to the industry or not. It's perfectly graduated by risk. The more you sell, the more you pay. There's no collection cost to the state, just a change in the formula. There's already a collection mechanism in place. There, nothing needs to be really changed. And the increase in the state revenue to attack a behavioral health problem, which has consequences for every facet of our society. Somebody mentioned the legal system, overburdened by chemical use issues. Okay? Somebody mentioned, is there a problem with that? One of the statistics I read, and I don't know that I can lay my hands on it, but 40% of the people doing alcohol in a jail, I think it was in Kentucky at the time, this is after they took out all the DWI people, okay? 40% of the people doing time in the county jail were under the influence of alcohol when they committed the crime they were incarcerated for. And they took out all the DWI people. I can tell you from my own history, when I was driving for detox, I went to a local jail to pick people up one morning, and they had everybody out folding laundry. They all knew my name. Hi, Bob, how's it going? Okay? They all knew me. Okay? Because many of them had been residents of the detox center. The most costly areas of the in our society, whether it's social services, the health care costs, or the criminal justice system, are affected by alcohol and drug use. It's an area that desperately needs our attention. The correct area for it is in the healthcare arena, and I'm very glad to be here today to offer this testimony. I have one other very brief story I'd like to say. I was doing a training on the ASAM dimensions in another state. Many states have adopted the ASAM dimensions. And I, having opinions and occasionally being willing to shoot my mouth off, said to the whole group of people, one of the things our society has done is over the last few years is we've changed our delivery system for human services from health care and Department of Human Services to the corrections model. And this is not to disparage anything that the Department of Corrections is doing. They're working really hard to provide excellent treatment. They're trying to meet licensing guidelines, all that stuff. So I'm not making a comment about that at all. And I had three young counselors sitting in the front, and they went... And so me, being intuitive and a counselor and everything, said, gee, how come you reacted so strongly? And they said, we work at a place that was a state hospital, and we have people in their same rooms when we were a state hospital, but now we're a prison. The same people in the same rooms at what I perceive to be has to be a much higher cost. Not only to the people, but to all of us in society. So I'd like to thank you for your attention to this area. And if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them. And we're running low on time. So.
Jumper. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Melson, can you tell us how much we're spending in aggregate on treatment in Minnesota every year from both public and private? And also, what does an individual treatment cost?
I cannot give you that number right off the top of my head, Ms. Bokalski. You may well have it. Just happens. $128 million.
Of which $89 million is the state appropriation.
And how about our individual, if you go in for a treatment for some kind of chemical dependency, what does it cost if you're there for 3 months?
It varies a great deal. One of the reasons we have redone the Rule 25 assessment is and the treatment rule under Rule 31 is so that we can individually give services to people as they need them. Okay, if you were to spend, I think I have a number here, if a person was to spend 90 days in a halfway house, one of the halfway houses that I have worked with in the past, it would be about $7,200. Okay? That's 90 days in a halfway house. Okay? Now, not everybody goes to a halfway house. We do individualized treatment. A lot of people go to outpatient treatment, which may cost about $2,500. Okay? And they don't get any housing.
that's one of the arguments for intervening sooner, is that people still have a place to live. And lots of times they're still working. And sometimes they can get back and forth to treatment because they haven't lost their driver's license yet. And so one of the arguments for intervening sooner is to be able to intervene and get people the treatment in a less costly arena.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to our guests. I have a number of questions. I appreciate your bringing forward sort of the difficulty of the financing at both the local and the state level, because I think that's really critical. And I heard nothing but good things about the proposed, or the, I guess, implementing rule changes, except that they're going to also increase local costs. And to be effective, they have to, but we have to figure out how to fill that gap. But I remember a few years ago looking at, it feels like we're kind of like where we were with tobacco maybe 10 years ago. And, you know, we're just sort of awareness of the problem and the long-term consequences and acceptance of raising taxes as a way to both do both prevention as well as fund needed responses. I haven't seen as many successful models in other states compared to what we were able to emulate with target market and really affecting that entry point of youth, the under 18s. And so we had some pathways that we could take advantage of, not that there wasn't some creativity in Minnesota, but we really were able to find other best practices in other states to lead us to that dramatic reduction. I haven't, the last time I looked quite a few years ago, I hadn't seen those same sort of routes to how do we get the awareness, the prevention, those messages out early in that youth population so we can do some prevention as well as early awareness. I think so many parents, so many teachers, others say, oh, well, it's just alcohol, and don't really realize the messages that they're sending. And so I'm wondering if there's some guidance that you could give us, or if you've looked at other states that we ought to be going on that end as well as some of the treatment changes that you've recommended.
I think there are a number of things we can do. All the research I've read over and over again, and all the studies that have been done, says that one of the most effective ways to change youth access and the binge drinking is to raise the price. Okay? It has worked with tobacco. It's a basic research tenet that raising the price, and for many people in here who might believe in free market systems, okay, raising the price decreases demand. Okay, that's what everybody says. Now, I don't know, okay, if you want to believe the research or not. Okay, alcohol is a very challenging situation for people to look at. Okay. I will use the quote from a politician to illuminate this. A congressman was once asked about his attitude toward alcohol. His answer was, if you mean the demon drink that poisons the mind, pollutes the body, desecrates family life, and inflames sinners, then I'm against it. But if you mean the elixir of Christmas cheer, the shield against winter chill, the taxable potion that puts needed funds into public coffers to comfort the little crippled children, then I'm for it. And I think our society suffers from that, okay? I guess I would ask you all to answer a question. How much drinking is too much on any one occasion? Our society has great difficulty giving anybody a clear answer on that, okay? NIAAA has developed a model that says 5 drinks on any one occasion is high-risk drinking. And yet, giving that message to our kids is sometimes very challenging for us. Okay? Very, very challenging for us. And I think it's very difficult. The prevention programs that Minnesota joined together, the Minnesota Prevention Resource Center, is working on educating people, educating parents. Some of the excise tax on alcohol could certainly be used to fund some of the prevention programs. And I'm going to say it again. Raising the price of alcohol is a prevention activity in and of itself.
Well, just to follow up, I totally agree, and I was going to offer a bill to increase it, but I knew Karen Clark and others had already done that. But if I totally buy the price argument about access, But the success, I think, in tobacco was about changing social norms and acceptability and turning the teens sort of against the tobacco industry and feeling being used. And this one feels more difficult to get to that next measure. And to me, because we do have kids who have access to money, and if they don't have it at 16, then they have it when they get the charge card when they go to college, and mom and dad doesn't know what all that monthly allowance is being used for. And I don't think that just raising the dollars and the cost is going to be enough. We have to change something in our culture, in peer pressure, in terms of the milieu that people are making those decisions. And that's where I'm wondering if we have some models to follow, because that's, I think, really what was the success in tobacco, was really about changing the perception and what's cool and what's not.
From my perspective, we have a lot of models, and we have some excellent people working in this field, and Ms. Falkowski has a couple of comments.
Well, I just think we should be heartened in Minnesota, because we have seen consistent declines not only in alcohol but in all other categories of drugs among young people for the past three times it's been administered. So that's a great trend. I think the real challenge, and so I think we're making progress. I think we administer and have a regional prevention system in the state that is working. At the same time, I'll give you an example. The city of Minneapolis used to have 30 people for the Minneapolis school system that worked with kids who were having drug and alcohol problems in the schools. They were sort of like the first line of intervention. And now, 10 years later, they have one person. There is a lot of unmet need in getting to kids early, and in spite of these declines we've seen. The second thing I just wanted to chime in on is college binge drinking. And that is a really hard nut to crack, because it occurs in a culture and in a state where we are at the top end of all the states in the country in terms of binge drinking. And when you think of what constitutes a community at a university, it's not just the current students, it's the alumni who, you know, want to raise money to build stadiums and come to football games there and all that. And there's really not consensus that all this extreme drinking in college is necessarily a harmful thing. I know people even who have started off their careers in alcoholism because of their college binge drinking. I know women who were sexually assaulted in college as a result of their college binge drinking. And somehow, as they age, they still look back fondly on college as being a time when they're able to not be responsible in life and binge drink. So there are fewer models to address college-age binge drinking. And it occurs in this state, being one of the states that has this larger culture, where binge drinking is more acceptable and more prevalent than in other states. So I don't know if that helps.
And I think you've hit on a very important point, is that it is about changing the social norms and the milieu. And one of the messages by raising the price that you and the legislature send is, you know, there really isn't anything that you have to be intoxicated to do. Is there? You know? Ken, I don't think there is. You can't do it sober, do you? Maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the first place. I don't know. Just a thought.
Representative Magnus. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple questions, and I apologize, I was not on the committee and got here late. But a question I have is, as you look at the trends, are you seeing an increased time frame for treatment programs that, as you look back over the last, say, 7-8 years, are you looking at a longer time frame for treatment programs?
I think we're looking at a more individualized way to deliver services that people need, as opposed to looking at just longer treatment. Okay? We're looking at ways to tailor the treatment experience to the person that is in need. We've used the example of diabetes today a couple of times. There are a wide range of treatments for diabetes delivered based on the symptoms that the person has and the tests that the doctor administers. Some of them are diet and exercise, then there's some things people call oral insulin, which I know aren't, but I don't remember the names of them now. And then some people go on insulin. And even within the people that go on insulin, the insulin dose is related to how their pancreas is functioning and their blood sugar and what kind of response. And that's the model we're actually moving towards in the state of Minnesota, is to be able to deliver treatment based on the symptoms that are present in the person that we're attempting to treat and the person that we're attempting to engage in long term in their own health care, which is what you try to do with diabetes and high blood pressure and high cholesterol, which has another much longer name I can't say either. But anyway, does that help to answer your question?
Well, it does, and that's encouraging. But I know there's different addictions that have had a lot more success with a longer-term treatment program.
Mm-hmm.
And my next question would be as you're looking at this, because I'm trying to figure out in a total program, because when I vote on some of these things, figure out what to do. What are you seeing the trend is for increased expenses then and increased cost for treatment? As you look to tailor the program, which I agree with you, I think that's good. What's that doing to the total overall cost of the program?
I'm not sure about exactly what the cost change will be. I guess I don't know how to answer that for sure. I think that by intervening earlier, we're going to be able to provide more people treatment in a less intensive setting. That's one of the goals of increasing the financial eligibility, is to be able to provide more people treatment in less intensive settings until they still have more individual resources left. A few years ago, I heard a story where they did a study, and again, I don't know where this is, but one of the studies was the vocation that had the highest recovery rate. Well, it happened to be airline pilots. Why was that? They still had two cars in the driveway. They still had houses. They still had families that cared about them. And guess what? They also had to go for physicals every 6 months. Okay? Lots of times it's the follow-up and the continuation, not the intensity, that makes the difference.
And Mr. Chairman, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say, in terms of addressing the cost of treatment, one of the things that happens when people are farther down the addiction scale before they get help, when they do get help, their needs are greater, and that can drive up the cost per unit of treatment, mm-hmm. not only with mental disorders, but other things that are exacerbated by longer-term addiction.
Thanks. And Mr. Chairman, one last question for me is this. Are you seeing other entities, other groups, other charity organizations, for example, step up more in helping with the addiction programs and funding side, support side, other things like this? Are you seeing an increase or sensing at least an increase in support from other entities outside of, frankly, government entities?
Well, Heart Salvation Army. Yeah. I mean, there are a whole bunch of, whole group of nonprofit organizations, the Salvation Army, the Heart organization, which funds treatment and stuff, which have long histories of being involved in helping, as William phrased it, the still-suffering alcoholic and drug addict. And those people are all still there and helping.
But are you, Mr. Chairman, are you seeing an increase in that in the last, say, 6, 7, 8 years, or do you have a sense on that?
I would be hesitant to say whether I've seen an increase or a decrease.
Okay.
Okay. I know they're all still there, working.
Thanks. Well, thank you, everybody, for we're a little at about 10 after 12 now. So thank you to the members for your following this, and to the presenters. It's been really helpful. You know, I thought one of the things that was most interesting was this notion, or one of the messages I took away, is this notion that early intervention makes a big difference. And we clearly have a problem as a state here, and so I hope as we go to the legislative session, we keep that in mind for ourselves, and that we kind of take the political will to intervene in fixing these problems sooner rather than later. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We're done.